Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. It's an afternoon of sophisticated fun with literature, poetry, opera, and film on our plate. First, Eddie Garcia chats it up with Daniel Handler. Daniel's perhaps better known as author Lemony Snicket, the man behind a series of unfortunate events, and we feel very fortunate to have him here with us today. Less fortunate, perhaps, was the Flying Dutchman. He made a deal with the devil that left him searching for a heart of gold for centuries. Piedmont Opera's Jamie Allbritten and soprano Carter Scott are here to deliver a happy but a bit soggy ending. We'll go behind the scenes with film producer, writer, and professor Dale Pollack. He takes us right up close to the sometimes disturbing intersection of violence and humor in film. And Bethany Chafin brings us full circle with Triad poet, author, educator Terry Kennedy. His publisher at Unicorn Press and a community of local artists have come together to create New River Breakdown. Next, after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got opera and film on today's show, but we begin and end with the written word. Getting published today is tough, but doable with lots of skill, dedication, and the ability to take lots and lots of rejection. But Eddie Garcia recently caught up with someone who's been thriving in this highly competitive world for quite some time.
The elusive author Lemony Snicket has written some of the most celebrated books for young readers of the past decade. The 13 volumes of A Series of Unfortunate Events have sold over 60 million copies worldwide and have been translated into 41 languages. The first three volumes of the series were turned into a film in 2004, starring Jim Carrey. Mr. Snicket has also written picture books for younger children, such as the Christmas story The Lotka Who Couldn't Stop Screaming, and his latest, simply titled The Dark. The latest series to be written by Lemony Snicket is called All the Wrong Questions. It's a four-volume story for young readers set in the shadowy worlds of crime fiction, inspired by the works of Raymond Chandler and the world of film noir. The second installment, When Did You See Her Last?, was released last Tuesday. Lemony Snicket has a scheduled appearance at Waite Chapel on the campus of Wake Forest University on Tuesday, October 22nd at 6:30 p.m. The event is presented by Bookmarks with support from Wake Forest University. And you can find ticket info at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Lemony Snicket, the man responsible for a series of unfortunate events, will most certainly not be joining us today. As disappointing as that may seem, I have been assured it's for the best. I was told this by Mr. Snicket's representative, Daniel Handler. While I cannot outright recommend you listen to the following interview, if you'd like to be disturbed, perplexed, or simply confused, the following interview may be of interest to you. You're going out on book tour. I guess you're probably about to head out, right?
I'm actually on book tour now. I'm in New York, but that is not where I live.
You live in San Francisco?
I do. I'm 3,000 miles away from home.
Oh.
Lonely.
I'm sorry.
In a room. That's all right.
Well, how's the tour been going so far?
The reporters from the school library journal begging to touch the hem of my garment. The tour is going well so far. I was at Comic-Con yesterday, New York's Comic-Con. Where I had never been before, and I'd never seen as many women dressed up as the Joker as I did yesterday. So that was a new experience for me. Have you been to a Comic-Con?
I have not been to a major one. I have been to a few small ones. I've been known to read a comic or two or 2,000. Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's such a big thing now, everyone dressing up like crazy and the cosplay, and never experienced that firsthand.
Well, I saw the costumes. I don't know what you mean by experiencing cosplay firsthand. I was a mere observer.
Oh, okay.
I was wearing a suit, which I guess is something of a costume. I wasn't dressed as a popular character, unless Lemony Snicket counts as one.
I'm going to go ahead and say congratulations on the release of your newest book.
That's very sweet of you to think of me. It's a book about a kidnapped girl, so I think a cause for celebration that a book about a kidnapped girl is loosed upon the world seems to be a little inappropriate, but if that's your level of professionalism, I'll try to adjust.
That's as professional as I can get. I'm sorry.
Oh dear. No, it's quite all right.
When Did You See Her Last is the second in the All the Wrong Questions series.
It's true. The first is Who Could That Be at This Hour?, which is about a stolen statue that turns out not to have been stolen, and so the statue must be stolen so that the case of the stolen statue can be solved. And then the second volume is When Did You See Her Last?, about a girl who goes missing, who turns out maybe to perhaps to want to go missing, although isn't the same girl as the girl they thought was missing. That was a confused pause you took, and I understand that it's complicated and upsetting, as the work of Lemony Snicket appears to be to nearly anyone who reads it.
I've had the fortune to read a good part of Who Could That Be at This Hour with my daughter, who was reading the book, but she read it much faster than I could keep up with. So I have a
That must be kind of upsetting for you that your daughter outclasses you as a reader.
She does, and she throws it in my face at every opportunity.
Oh, dear.
I would have heard you the interview, but maybe next time.
You started to offer an excuse why your daughter wasn't there, and then you suddenly got vague.
Well, it's Columbus Day, so she's off of school, but she was up late because They Might Be Giants were in town last night.
And oh, were they?
Yeah, so we got to go to the show. They did do Fingerprints, a suite of really short songs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was really impressive. They did that their second encore. Yeah, and my daughter is 9. She had a really good time. She got X's on her hand for the first time.
You she know, X on her hands?
She got marked with X's for being underage, you know.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you haven't introduced your daughter to the joys of ecstasy. That's
that's
of some comfort to me.
Oh, well, thank you. Some of the characters in All the Wrong Questions have inadvertently been introduced to some unprescribed drugs, haven't they?
Well, it's true. Laudanum, a drug that makes people drowsy and occasionally unconscious, is a device used by various villains in All the Wrong Questions in this new series. But I wouldn't call it really a recreational drug. I guess it's a recreational drug for the villains. I hadn't thought of it that way. They enjoy knocking people unconscious, the better to drag them into unpleasant situations. I guess that counts as a recreational drug.
So what drew you to the going the noir genre route for young readers?
Well, one day I was reading a noir novel by Raymond Chandler, and it suddenly hit me that the journey of a detective is virtually identical to the journey of a child. A person is told by various authority figures to complete various tasks that turn out to be more sinister and complicated than they thought, and then they're told to lay off the case and stop asking questions, and soon they need to find their own moral path in a world that is completely corrupt and treacherous. That's basically the same thing that we all go through when we're born and adults begin bossing us around. So I thought it would be interesting to go back in time when Mr. Snicket was a young lad and an apprentice in a secret organization and think about when he was up to the various nefarious deeds that eventually made him the broken and Byronic figure that we come to know and shudder over in a series of unfortunate events.
What is it about putting children in these dangerous situations that appeals to you?
What appeals to me? About putting children in dangerous situations?
Well, in your novels.
Nothing, sir. You're the one with the daughter you dragged to rock concert.
That's probably the least dangerous rock concert she could attend, I'd imagine.
I don't know. I'm sure we could think of something. How about Air Supply?
All right, you got me.
I think when you're reading a book and people are in danger, it's interesting. I think when you're in life and people are in danger, it's another thing altogether. That's why I find that the Snicket books tend to lead to people putting themselves in danger in real life, and that's why personally I'm against them. But, you know, other people host radio shows and talk positively about books in which young girls go missing. That's other people's moral choices. I try not to judge.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about something I'm curious about with a series of unfortunate events.
Sure.
It was turned into a film starring Jim Carrey as Count Olaf. What are your feelings about how the adaptation turned out?
Well, the movie combines 3 volumes of a series of unfortunate events into 2 hours. So the pain and suffering in about 600 pages of material is condensed. And so whether you want to read the books and have that suffering drawn out, but perhaps to a lesser degree with every passing moment, or you prefer to have your pain and suffering concentrated like that, I think it depends. It really depends on whether you're the sort of person who likes to rip the Band-Aid right off, or whether you like to slowly, slowly pull it.
Well,
which are you?
Rip it right off.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
The Count has an eye on his ankle and lives in a horrible place. He wants all your money, he's never at all funny. He wants to remove your face. And you might be thinking...
Let's talk about music a little bit.
Okay.
So you play accordion,
I do.
Yeah. How did you get your start playing accordion?
I was in college, and I had taken piano for years, and I wanted to be in a band, and it was during a brief moment in American musical history when no keyboard instruments were cool. So I took up the accordion so I could be in a band. So I like to say that I'm one of the few people who ever took up accordion basically to meet women. I'm married now, so it all worked out fine.
Yeah, that definitely worked out. Now, you've collaborated with Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Field on a number of occasions.
I have.
How did that collaboration start?
It started with my admiring of his work and moving to New York, where I knew that he lived. And through various vague circumstances, I was introduced to his manager, and I said, oh, I really like Stephen Merritt, and I would like to work with him. And she said, well, he goes to the same diner every day where he sits and writes songs. You could just go find him there. So I went and found him there, and I looked up and I said, hello, I'm Daniel Handler, and I admire your work very much. And he said, what are you reading? And I said, oh, The Spoils of Poynton by Henry James. And he said, well, that's never been my favorite Henry James novel. And then we started talking, and we still talk.
That's great. And then have you played, you've played on some Magnetic Fields recordings or things with the Archie?
Yes. Right when we were first becoming associates, I had just had the idea for a series of unfortunate events, and he had just had the idea for 69 love songs. So we ended up helping each other. He wrote one song for each volume in a series of unfortunate events, which were collected as The Tragic Treasury by one of his bands, the Gothic Archies. Now have to call the Gothic Arches because of a cease and desist order from Archie Comics.
Oh.
And thanks, Archie Comics, for spoiling our party. We appreciate it. And then I played accordion on 69 Love Songs and a few other Magnetic Fields records also, and I tour with them when it's convenient and when they're going to a glamorous location. It's really quite a deal for me when they call me and they say, we're going to London to perform 69 Love Songs at the Hammersmith Ballroom. Would you like to come? I say, but of course. And when they say, we'll be touring the Midwest in the middle of the searing heat. Would you like to come? I say, oh, I wish I could. I'm so busy. Rat.
Yeah, you've ironed out a perfect deal with Mr. Merritt, it seems.
Yeah.
People gawk at the way you walk, you're a freak show. People squawk about the way you talk, you're a freak show.
Other music that you've worked on, The Composer is Dead, it's from a classical piece, corresponds with the text.
Yes, I collaborated with the composer Nathaniel Stuckey on a piece called The Composer is Dead. It is a little bit like Peter and the Wolf in that it is a piece for narrator and orchestra that introduces the instruments of the orchestra to people who might not be familiar with them. It is a crime, The Composer is Dead, and each section of the orchestra is questioned by the inspector. So I like to say that it's Peter and the Wolf meets an episode of Law and Order.
Has this been performed live, or is it just available?
Oh, it's been performed all over the place by orchestras across the world. For many years, it was the most performed piece of new music, which is almost exactly like being the world's tallest midget. And then it was adapted for theater. It's just been all over the place. Oh. I believe they're performing it in Australia, even as we speak.
Oh, wow.
Although I can't remember what time it is in Australia.
No idea.
Not to mention that this is a pre-taped interview, so I don't even know what time it is when I'm saying what time is it.
Some more recent works. You worked on a children's, you know, younger children's book, The Dark.
Yes, a picture book. Mr. Clausen, the award-winning illustrator of such books as This Is Not My Hat and I Want My Hat Back, moved on from hats to more darker material in our book, The Dark, which is the story of a boy named Laszlo who is afraid of the dark, and then the dark starts speaking to him. It's a terrifying work, and so was for some reason marketed towards very young children.
How does that kind of collaboration work with an illustrator like that, especially when it is a picture book, so driven by the images and for younger children? Are you doing it in tandem, or do you write the text and he supplies the illustrations?
Well, it really depends. I mean, I've also worked with Myra Kalman, who is a very skilled illustrator, and she and I had a collaboration. But John Clausen is basically a worthless, treacherous human being. And so I had to hold his hand and boss him around and, offer him ridiculous incentives to keep going. He's a big a fan of the food at P.F. Chang's, and so I would have to offer him, you know, chances to have pot stickers or things like that if he only continued his work. So it was really quite difficult for me, and despite the fact that he appears to be a very charming and competent person and have won many awards and have best-selling books that he's written and illustrated all by himself, he really needed to be treated like an infant.
Mm. Will you be working with him again in the future? Or are you
yeah,
done?
I will. Oh, lots of times I will, yeah. I wouldn't trust him to wander around by himself, frankly. Mm. For this tour, he won't be accompanying me, so I had to take him to a bus station and tell him to stay there for about a month.
When I was preparing for the interview, I discovered that you've written some books for adults as well, which I did not know that, such as Why
I'm Sorry, I should have written you, but I haven't been in touch with you the way I've liked.
No one told me about Why We Broke Up and Adverbs and Watch Your Mouth. Do you have a separate audience for these books, or is it, you know, the parents of the children that read a series of fortunate events, or is it the kids, you know, sneaking into the house that like your other books?
Well, kind of both. The more I go out on tour, though I don't appear to age myself, I meet many people who say they have grown up with my books who appear more or less to be adults, and now they're reading some of those books. But there's always been a loyal, well, they describe themselves as a cult following. I'm not comfortable with that because, you know, it's not like they live in isolation and worship me as a god, despite my encouragement. But there is an audience for those books, and they come out. So I think there's a little bit of a Venn diagram between the work of Daniel Handler and the work of Lemony Snicket.
Okay.
I'm sorry you were unaware of it, though. That makes me feel bad.
Well,
I should have written you a postcard, at least. Where were my manners? Do you think our friendship can survive this?
I think it can. I think it definitely can.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yes.
Then I won't worry about it anymore.
So you'll be here in Winston soon.
Yes.
What can we expect from a live Daniel Handler, Lemony Snicket experience?
Well, Lemony Snicket never shows up, and so I have to show up in his place, and I think it's usually frustrating and disappointing for all involved. And, I mean, you know, from my own travels in Winston-Salem before, I know that you people are already of fragile temperaments, and many of you are already verging on mental illness. So I would suggest to anyone at Winston-Salem to stay home rather than attending this Lemony Snicket event, which is sure only to drive them even madder than perhaps they already are.
Hmm. Would that go for children as well? Do you want them to stay home, stay behind?
Definitely. Would encourage people to drop off children at a disappointing event and then disappear into the night of Winston-Salem? What sort of person do you think I am?
I think you're putting words into my mouth.
I see. Yeah, well, maybe I'm just making assumptions about the sort of man who would abandon his daughter at a They Might Be Giants concert. Put an X on her hand and have her listen to Fingertips. What's the worst that could happen?
If people do show up at this event, you will possibly give us a chance to say hello, the children, the adults who...
Yes, well, I'll be forced to do a small presentation explaining Mr. Snicket's absence and perhaps saying what he would have wanted to say had he been able to show up, and then people will stand in line to insult me or perhaps say hello, yes.
Well, we're looking forward to the event here in Winston-Salem.
I can't imagine why, but that's sweet of you to say.
All right. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome. Thank you for your interest. I hope nothing terrible happens to you today.
I have known little civility, sir.
Author Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. Mr. Snicket has a scheduled appearance at Waite Chapel on the campus of Wake Forest University on Tuesday, October 22nd at 6:30 p.m. The event is presented by Bookmarks with support from Wake Forest University. Mr. Snicket will most likely not be in attendance at this event, and you may be stuck listening to Daniel Handler, but I have a feeling either way you'll have a great time. You can find ticket info at WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. For WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia.
When you play the violin.
Technical producer Eddie Garcia. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break right now. When we get back, we take to the high seas with a salty salute to opera king Richard Wagner. His Flying Dutchman comes to the Triad next weekend, compliments of Piedmont Opera. Conductor Jamie Albritton and acclaimed soprano Carter Scott are here to share this tall tale and the great Wagner music behind it next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and later on the show, we'll be going behind the scenes with film producer, writer, and film professor Dale Pollack. He'll explore that gnarly nexus between violence and humor in film. But first, it's time for Dick Wagner and the Chromatics. That'd be Richard Wagner, the great 19th century German opera composer who took this centuries-old tradition, turned it on its head, and called it Gesamtkunstwerk, total artwork. Dick Wagner and the Chromatics was actually the name I wanted to give my woodwind quintet back in college, but alas, Richard wasn't all that big on chamber music, and even less so for chamber music for winds. What Wagner did compose, hundreds and hundreds of pages worth, was opera. His first complete opera, The Fairies, came at the age of 20. This effort went unproduced until shortly after his death in 1883, but Wagner was unfazed by early operatic stumbles. Somewhere in between, he composed about a dozen others, many of which are considered masterpieces. Wagner's most famous Ring Cycle is a set of four enormous operas based loosely on elements of Germanic mythology. Wagner knew a good story when he heard one, and the legend of the Flying Dutchman struck his fancy long before the Ring. You see, there is this arrogant Dutchman who thought that he could sail around the Cape, making a bet with the devil in the process. Well, he lost that bet, and to lift the devil's curse, he's forced to sail the high seas for centuries in search of the one woman who will love him truly and forever. The Dutchman is given one chance every 7 years to come on land and try to find his one true love, and Friday, October 25th, is his lucky day. That's when the Piedmont Opera's production of Richard Wagner's Flying Dutchman comes to the Stevens Center of the UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. Performances continue Sunday the 27th and Tuesday the 29th when the Flying Dutchman finds the lovely Zenta, sung by acclaimed soprano and UNC School of the Arts alumna Carter Scott. When we first meet Zenta, we find her not pining away for her boyfriend Eddie, but staring lovingly at a portrait that hangs on the wall of her father's factory. It's a mysterious man about whom exists a legend, and of the legend there is a folk song, which she sings, The Legend of the Flying Dutchman. Piedmont Opera's Jamie Albritton gets us up to speed.
As she begins to sing the song, she sort of loses her focus and says in the middle of the song, "My goodness, if he could only love one woman, let it be me, let it be me." And lo and behold, who shows up at the house but the man himself, the Flying Dutchman. And she falls desperately in love with him. She's going to leave with him, but as she approaches the dock, her boyfriend Eddie comes and says, "What are you, out of your mind? I love you. Don't go with this awful man." And the Dutchman overhears it, and he says, "That's it. I have to find the one woman who is true to me, and it's clear that you are not she. I must wander the seas again." And he takes off, and at that moment, Zenta, horrified, leaps off the dock and jumps into the ocean, and the two of them are united forever.
And that's just the story. And
that's
then we get into the music,
story.
And which from the very beginning, from the overture, is something just spectacular and new with... Did these wind machines...
Oh, there's a wind machine in the orchestra.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Just describe that much of it, just as a little entree, because I think it's cool.
A wind machine?
Yeah. How do they make that sound?
You should ask John Beck, our percussion teacher over at UNCSA, because he built one.
I was going to say, maybe I did it. Yeah.
He did. The one that he built, anyway, there's a piece of canvas over top of this. It's a wheel. And the wheel has, across the outside of it, there are wooden slats. And then over top of the wheel, there's a piece of canvas. And you turn the wheel, and the slats rub up alternately against the canvas. And so you hear this sort of... And that's the wind machine.
But that just sets the scene, the overture to the Flying Dutchman. Then we get into the singing. And Zenta, tell me about singing this particular role, technical challenges, and just approaching it from the singer's standpoint.
Sure. The most famous is, I think, the Dutchman duet, which every soprano dreams of singing. It's beautiful. It's a gift to sing it. In fact, I was working with a friend of mine up in New York, and the first time I sang it with him, with a baritone in my ear, I almost could not make it through it. I was just so overcome with emotion. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
there are some people who are afraid to sing these things, but I'm not, because my voice sits in these areas.
Why would they be afraid?
Well, the orchestra is big. The tessitura, just like Turandot, is very high. I'm doing air quotes now. It's Wagner. Things like that. But, I mean, that's kind of where I am now in my maturity.
You can't, for non-singers, you can't just, well, I'm not familiar with singers who just jump out of the conservatory and become Wagnerian, this, that, and the other thing. So talk about that development, what you need to have physically to be able to take on these roles, and why you need to have that.
Well, a very famous, wonderful Wagnerian, Birgit Nilsson, was asked the same question. She said, what does a singer need to sing Wagner roles? And she said, very comfortable shoes. They're long. They are long.
It's a lot of singing. And the range?
It's just very different. It's very different from Puccini. It's very different from Verdi. These are the things I sing. It's very different from Mozart. I think you have to have a lot of breath support because there's a beautiful cadenza in this thing. I mean, there are some coloratura passages, but it's not Rossini coloratura. In fact, I sang Third Norn in Washington with the National Opera, and I walked into the first rehearsal and I thought, oh my God, I'm with my people. They're big people. Wagnerians are big people.
Big folk.
Yeah, and the stage is big. How long it takes them to say, I love you, is long. You know, it's just, it's grand.
We hear this name, Wagner, all the time. Mozart, Wagner opera. He had his hands in every aspect of the production virtually.
Absolutely.
Talk about that just in itself. This guy changed the whole concept of the art.
Perhaps the most significant thing is that he was both librettist and composer. You know, what's interesting is that when he was a young man, he started out wanting to be a playwright. And he went to see a production of Egmont with Beethoven's incidental music. And he came away sort of dumbfounded and said, I understand now. I have to write everything. Because it was the music that made the play mean so much to him. So he went home and basically said, Mom, help me. I got to learn how to write music. And began to write music after that. He went on to have a vision about stage directions that he writes in his librettos. They're so incomprehensible for that time period.
And within that, you mentioned leitmotif, Carter. First off, describe leitmotif and how, you know, what it's used to represent in the case of this Dutchman opera and the challenges, I guess, of really using that effectively.
This is early Wagner. This is his first mature work. He's really sort of figuring out the leitmotif construction. I think that he learned a tremendous amount from Beethoven. And Beethoven, you know, he doesn't write so much themes as he writes motives.
Little motives, yeah.
And I think that he took from Beethoven that motivic idea. And in Dutchman, there are motives that connect to individuals. And that's how he, just as Beethoven constructs his symphony from these little motivic ideas, Wagner constructs his operas in using these motivic ideas. But he hasn't fully worked out the leitmotif idea. Yes, we have, as you know from the overture, the very first tune you hear is the tune that's connected with the Dutchman. But there are also motives that just exist sort of in a symphonic form as motives that begin to build the fabric of this opera. From the greatest musician to the most humble amateur, people who love Wagner's operas love to study it because it's like a never-ending puzzle. And just when you think you've understood something, there's another puzzle piece over there that you didn't see. So I think it's great to study it, but like so much of opera, you don't have to understand anything. What you have to prepare yourself for is such a very, very rich evening of music making. And whether you understand anything about motivic construction or not, that's not the point, because what it creates is this subliminally active world that you are literally immersed in, and you come away with such a very rich theatrical experience, I think.
Can I interject something?
I wish you would, Carter.
Golly. I'm so old. I graduated in 86 from School of the Arts. I actually call it School of the Arts, but you guys are calling it something else. UNCSA. Okay.
We have a U now.
My music history professor, Dr. Gray, he would do the drop the needle tests and would lecture and all these kinds of things. And here we were, you know, college kids. All we wanted to do was sing and have people clap for us. Anyway, he said to us when we were in the romantic period of which Wagner is a part of, he exposed us to these things, as did my opera lit professor, also Norman Johnson, may he rest in peace. He said, however, we're listening to these on a vinyl, Wagnerian operas, but both Dr. Gray and Norman said, you have to experience Wagner in the theater. And as a kid, I was like, ugh, you know, these old guys, I don't know what they're talking about. You know, it's just music, gah. And when I finally got to Germany and I was able to experience Wagner in the theater, I have a very good friend, John Fiore, who does a lot of Ring cycles, and he's very, very much into performing Wagner's music. He invited me down to Dusseldorf to see Parsifal on Good Friday, if you know anything about Parsifal, that's when you want to see Parsifal.
Is it the longest Wagnerian opera as well?
It's like 6 hours, I'm telling you. And I like to sing opera. I don't like to go to opera.
Let's just get that up front.
Exactly. And so I thought, oh, Lord have mercy, I'm going to sit in this theater for 6 hours. But let me tell you, I did not want it to end.
Yeah.
That's how amazing it was. And this is from a cynical, like, busman's holiday type thing. I did not want to leave the theater. And again, if you know Parsifal, there's like an echo chorus that comes from elsewhere. And they were like behind me. And it was just unbelievable. And I didn't know anything about that opera, you know. And this was my first exposure to Wagner, my first exposure to Parsifal, my first exposure to a six-hour opera. I feel strongly about this. If you're able to see Wagner in the States, do it, because it's something that needs to be experienced in the theater. I can't say that enough. It really, that the sounds engulf you.
Acclaimed soprano and UNC School of the Arts alumna Carter Scott. She was joined by conductor Jamie Albritton. You can celebrate the 200th anniversary of Wagner's birth with the Piedmont Opera production of The Flying Dutchman on Friday, October 25th at the Stevens Center of the UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. Performances continue Sunday the 27th and Tuesday the 29th, and you'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. When we come back from this short break, we'll take a peek behind the scenes with film scholar Dale Pollack. And Bethany Chafin has a New River breakdown with author Terry Kennedy, Unicorn Press, and a team of local artists next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to go behind the scenes with film producer, writer, and University of North Carolina School of the Arts film professor Dale Pollack. Dale's produced 13 feature films. His movie Blaze, starring Paul Newman, was nominated for an Academy Award for cinematography. Dale was chief film reviewer for Daily Variety, chief film reporter for the Los Angeles Times, where he was a Pulitzer Prize nominee, and author of Skywalking, The Life and Films of George Lucas. Dale Pollack is currently professor of cinema studies at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts.
As we look back on our culture in America, movies have always represented a kind of unique threat. In many cases, people saw them as a danger to society. In the 1920s, it was sex. In the 1930s, it was about promoting gangsterism. In the 50s, it was glorifying communism. In the 70s, it was sex and violence. And it's pretty much been violence ever since. But recently, we've seen a new development: the conflation of extreme violence and extreme humor. And certain movies like Fight Club and especially Pulp Fiction really launched this new era in which there's a very thin line between terror and humor. And of course, the modern horror film has exploited that for all it's worth, because we laugh sometimes when we're scared. Look at the roller coaster rides in amusement parks. That's what they're designed for. So I think the question we have to ask is, what do we justify for the purposes of entertainment? And in recent years, we've seen this new genre, the action violent comedy. One of them was made by an alum of the school where I teach, University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and our most famous alum, David Gordon Green, made his most successful film a few years ago, Pineapple Express. Now, when I saw that film, one image really stayed with me, and that was a hot iron applied to a man's face, and the audience erupted in laughter. More recently, I went and saw Kick-Ass 2, which, like its predecessor, Kick-Ass is based on a comic book. And in this case, people were laughing when people were shot point blank in the face, in the chest, when knives were plunged into people. This was the source of great humor in the theater where I saw the film. Now, this is a movie where Jim Carrey, one of its stars, actually publicly distanced himself from the film he stars in due to its extremely high level of violence, in which 15-year-old characters go around literally blowing people away. So the question is, why do we now treat violence as a source of hilarity? Is it really a critique of the youth culture's obsession with violence in modern society, and one way to handle that is through satire? Is it a good thing that we laugh until it hurts by seeing pain inflicted on people? And I guess we have to ask ourselves if gore and humor can be put to a good purpose, to show the stupidity of random violence and the lure of bloodshed. I somehow don't think so. I think this is actually one of the more dangerous trends I've seen in contemporary American cinema. You don't see it so much overseas, and perhaps it really is a reflection of our culture's obsession with firearms and with gun power. But it's a disturbing trend, and as a new generation grows up with this being the norm, what's going to happen to our society? What's going to happen to movies? Are we going to see a continual escalation of this trend, or is it just going to be over at some point?
Marvin, what do you make of all this?
Man, I don't even have an opinion.
Well, you gotta have an opinion. I mean, do you think that God came down from heaven and stopped? Oh,
what's happening?
Oh, man, I shot Marvin in the face.
Why the you do that?
Well, I didn't mean to do it. It was an accident. Oh,
man. I think back to something Quentin Tarantino said after the release of Pulp Fiction. If a guy gets shot in the stomach and he's bleeding like a stuck pig, then that's what I want to see. Not a man with a stomach ache and a little red dot on his belly. So now that violence has become the best form of cinema entertainment and, in a way, cinema amusement, we've clearly reached a new plateau. But is it an upward plateau or a downward one? I don't think there's an easy judgment to make about this. All I know is, on a certain level, it sickens and disgusts me.
Behind the Scenes with Professor of Cinema Studies at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, Mr. Dale Pollack. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to return to the world of books. The Piedmont Triad has a long history of excellent poets, authors, and small publishers. Bethany Chafin sat down recently to explore one such outfit that calls Greensboro home, a new collection of prose poetry, and the author behind the work.
Terry Kennedy's new collection of poetry, New River Breakdown, is a work of art on many levels. The collection, published by Greensboro-based Unicorn Press, contains 44 beautiful poems, is hand-stitched, yes, each and every one, and every book will have one of five original works of art as the cover. Terry and his publisher, Andrew Salters, collaborated with four local artists for the covers: Tristan Miller, Woody Anderson, Matthew Brinkley, Chuck Johnson, and Andrew himself. Each created a piece of art inspired by Terry's work. New River Breakdown will be released this Sunday, October 20th. Terry, who is also the associate director of the graduate program in creative writing at UNC Greensboro, stopped by WFDD to read from and discuss the collection. He was joined by Andrew Salters of Unicorn Press, as well as two of the artists who contributed their work to the project, Tristan Miller and Woody Anderson. Terry, tell me a little bit about New River Breakdown. How long have you been writing these poems? Was it a project that had a clear beginning and end, or is this a collection of poems you've been writing over the course of maybe years?
I've been working on the poems about 8 years, and it's really been in the last 3 years or so that it became a cohesive collection, a singular idea, the collection of prose poems that I kind of went back and worked on for a couple years before Andrew looked at it and decided that he would like to publish it for Unicorn Press.
You use the term prose poems. Could you tell us a little bit about what a prose poem is, what it looks like or even sounds like?
For me, I think that if you were to listen to the poems out loud, they might sound just the same as if you were looking in a traditionally lineated poem. But the prose poem on the page looks more like prose. So you have that sort of margin-to-margin lineation as opposed to other forms where it might be the lines might be broken, jagged in different places. And I felt like the prose poem was appropriate for this manuscript, for this book, for different reasons. But mostly I wanted it to reach people who wouldn't necessarily read poetry, people who are scared of it.
And Andrew, could you tell me a little bit more about Unicorn Press? Is it a standard practice to have all of your books be hand-bound?
It was established by Alan Brilliant in 1966. Al has produced largely hand-bound books. Toward the end of the 80s, some of those books were machine-bound, but many of them have been printed on letterpress. Almost all of them have included hand-binding as the end assembling process.
Terry, what do you think it means to this collection to have it be published by Unicorn in this way?
Unicorn Press has such a long history and has put books out by so many wonderful poets, so many nationally recognized poets. That also was really flattering to me. The other opportunity that I thought was really great was having the opportunity to work with the local artists who did the cover art for the book. Everybody brought something a little bit different to it. And when I look at the cover, I can say, wow, well, this really speaks to this aspect of the book.
But Andrew, could you tell us about how the idea for having multiple covers came about?
Well, actually, that's probably a product of the small press process, because when I get together with Terry, as we were doing last fall, it was Terry who was like, what if we did this? You know, what if we tried that? And I was like, yes, please. That would be great. And since then, Terry's been all like, well, you know, a lot of publishers maybe would have said, let's not do five covers. And I'm like, I don't know why any publisher would turn that down. But I guess maybe he's right.
And Woody, I'm going to ask you to describe what you came up with for your cover, and then Tristan, I want to hear about your cover as well. So Woody, if you could tell us about that.
So my cover actually is for the hardbound edition. And when I read Terry's work, I was really struck with the imagery there. It was just really rich, rich imagery. And what the concept that came to mind was an idea of a riverbed with layers of debris and organic matter, like leaves and the tracks of creatures and people that had visited there, just sort of that whole passage of time aspect. So I wanted to create a piece that was sort of a patina of life of that. So the concept was to take the fabric for the book covers and print layer after layer of imagery and drawing on there. So each cover for the hardback edition is an original piece, and the background of the cloth is printed with all these layers and organic images, and then it's overprinted with the book title. I'm working with the piece as it's changing and as I'm adding layers and they're interacting with each other and washing or dyeing and fading away. It sort of becomes this very organic process that is very natural, and I don't have as much control over it as I might have in a more traditional printmaking process. situation, and I think it worked well with this, what I found in Terry's book when I read it. Mm-hmm. I thought it turned out to be a great match.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to work with fibers?
Yeah, I think traditionally it sort of gets boxed away as maybe women's work, or maybe it gets a little less respect. But actually, it's just another form of a canvas if you think about it that way. But I really enjoy working with fabrics in my work, and often I'll work with reclaimed fabric. So I'll print on bed sheets, and so that's in the life of the object before I'm turning it into my art is a whole other side of the process. But for this project, we used linen, which that fiber is very resilient and resistant to change, which is sort of poetic in its own way and actually really added to the process because it meant I had less control, but it also gave the finished pieces a very tactile quality. So if someone spends time with that book and interacts with it as an object, I think that they're really going to get something out of it. I mean, we're making a choice now when we want to spend time with a real book, and I think that the covers are sort of adding to that process too in some way.
Definitely.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, completely. Tristan, how did you approach your cover?
I knew that whatever I was going to do for the cover had to stay analog. I didn't want any digital process coming into it. So just like Woody, my covers were screen printed. But my project for my cover was a collaboration. I had a screen printer that is a friend of mine who I knew that I wanted him to print the book covers, and then I would come up with the original image for it. And how I was going to pass that on to him was making sure that there was no digital process, i.e. like photocopying and making the transparency for burning the screen. For screen printing, you have to burn a positive image into the screen with the photo emulsion. I'm very interested in that while making the drawing, I'm fully present. Every mark that's made has an intention. But I don't necessarily have a map. I don't necessarily have an exact plan. It grows organically. So I am not in control completely. As far as the imagery, though, as I kept working with the book, reading with the book every night before I went to bed, one of the things I kept feeling this emotional sense of like trying to keep your head above water, just trying to get through the situation. And rivers flood. And I think when there's moments in the each poem that I feel that the speaker is just being overwhelmed, but quietly trying to tread water to stay afloat. So my cover really kind of looks like the rising of a tide, even though it's very simple and there's these repetitive swirling marks over and over. It does have a shift in energy and movement just like water, but it's also supposed to look like it's rising. So that it doesn't necessarily look like the riverbed, but it may feel as if you are being consumed by the river.
Morning, Minnesot. It is morning, and the pelicans are filling the sky. They glide silently past, stare at the choppy river below. The right cuff of my pants is soaked as we walk up the beach together. I say, together, but she is far ahead of me, slender and fleet, a spring doe skimming the sand. The game we play is an ancient one. You know the name. You made the rules. A crab at the edge of the pier clacks his blue claws and scowls. And the gulls diving from the sky are maniacal. Compelled by greed, they fall, gleaming white missiles. She is so far ahead of me now that I plan for tomorrow. The pelicans, ugly with patience and wisdom, glide gently past. The hungover fishermen finish their coffee, pull on their rubber boots. Around the bend, the ferry churns the dark water white, gives three long bellows of its horn.
John, get your plane now.
Something that I find fascinating about all of the poems in this are the way you play with distance, whether that be emotional distance or physical distance, or distance across time or seasons and things like that. And I think you set that up really perfectly here because, yeah, you say, we walk up the beach together. I say together, but she is far ahead of me. And that seems to be a theme carried throughout. There's this closeness and intimacy about the relationships that you describe, but then there's always this indication that there's a lot in between. So could you talk about that maybe a little bit?
You really did hit on sort of one thing in the book, this idea of relationships and how close we can be to somebody else. How really close can we be? You know, you could think about your grandparents being married for 60 years and that they know everything there is to know about each other. But we can't really know everything about each other. There's always that little bit of separation between us as human beings, and it's part of the human experience. It don't matter what
I do if I Poet and Associate Director of the Graduate Program in Creative Writing at UNC Greensboro, Terry Kennedy. He was joined by Assistant Editor and Book Designer at Unicorn Press, Andrew Salters, Greensboro-based artist Tristan Miller, and Winston-Salem-based artist Woody Anderson. You can hear Terry read from New River Breakdown on Wednesday, November 6th at 7 p.m. in Phillips Hall at High Point University. You'll find more information on our guests, and you can also see each of the 5 original covers created for New River Breakdown on our website, wfdd.org. Click on Try Out Arts Weekend once you're there.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. Bethany, along with technical producer Eddie Garcia and myself, produce the show each week, and you'll find links to archived episodes and podcasts at wfdd.org and click on Try Out Arts Weekend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for us, you can send those to triadarts@wfu.edu. Next week, it's violinist Kevin Lawrence live in Studio A with a mind-blowing solo violin sonata by J.S. Bach. And then I'm off to Sika for a gallery tour with Mark Leach and everything you ever wanted to know about graphic design. Eddie Garcia and Bethany Chafin cover geek girl culture at next week's comic book convention in Greensboro. We'll have rhythm and brass and a whole lot more next Friday, so see you then. In the meantime, I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.